This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, welcome to The Country Hour. I am Cassie Huff, and I don't know if you're keen on the sale yards. They're quite the place to be at the moment, with huge amounts being paid for livestock across the country. The Australian new season lamb record has once again been broken. I'll tell you what the price was shortly. But I'm also interested to know just how important sale yards are to you. Even if you're not selling or buying, do you still like to know what's going on?
The joy that it brings, or I guess maybe it's even the sense of belonging and connection for everybody. It doesn't matter whether they're vendors, agents, buyers. I have a real sense that there's a sense of fun and camaraderie that happens at sale yards.
There's some research work being done on Australian sale yards and their importance from a social point of view. And I'd love to know what you think about this, whether they have been an important place for you to meet up with people. Perhaps you live a long way from town and it's your chance to catch up with people you know. You can text me your feelings about sale yards and their social importance to your community on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Now, I'd love to know your stories because I'm sure there's a lot out there. In particular, my own family has a bit of a connection to the local sale yards, because when my mother was going into labour with my sister, she rang the local exchange. It was back in the day when we had party lines, and she rang Mrs. Baker. Mrs. Baker said, "Oh, have you had your baby yet?" And she said, "She's on her way right now." And Mrs. Baker took it upon herself to let everyone know. And Mum said in particular, "Tim's actually at the sale yards and I can't get a hold of him." And Mrs. Baker said, "Leave it with me." And she managed to get an announcement across the loudspeakers at the sale yards. "Tim Huff, your wife is in labour. Please head straight to the hospital." So sale yards were pretty important at letting my father know that Mum was in labour at the time, when you didn't have mobile phones, to let people know what was going on. So I'd love to know your stories on how important sale yards have been to you over the years. You can text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. But before we get to that, a few hurdles this morning have been thrown the way of JBS's $175 million acquisition of Rivalea Holdings. If successful, JBS would supply a third of Australia's pig meat. But now the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has detailed preliminary competition concerns about the deal. Peter Somerville talked through those concerns with Deputy Chair Mick Keogh.
The strong concern, or the primary concern we have, is that with the acquisition, JBS would own three of the four export accredited pig abattoirs in southern Australia. So they already own a facility at Port Wakefield. They would, with this acquisition, pick up the Rivalea abattoir at Corowa and also the main service abattoir at Diamond Valley. So with those three, they would be in a very strong position in relation to the provision of service kills in southeastern Australia. And when we add to that the ownership of Primo, which has a very strong position in the small goods market, that creates some concerns around the extent to which those vertical arrangements could be used to disadvantage other competitors, for example, of Primo in the market, who have to source their fresh pork, for example, through one of those abattoirs.
So it's about processing, but also flows through to the retail side of things.
Well, Rivalea and JBS don't operate at the retail end at the moment, but the wholesalers and processors who acquire fresh pork from those, process through those facilities, and then transform that into either retail-ready cuts or small goods, are dependent on those facilities, and therefore that would flow through to retail if, for example, there was a substantial cost increase imposed on the users of those facilities. So the processors would potentially face higher costs through the slaughter facilities, and that in turn would have to translate through to higher prices at retail, and that's the concern.
These are preliminary competition concerns. What does that mean? Are they things you'll investigate later on?
Yeah, the process basically involves us looking at areas where there may be competition concerns, and then we signal through our statement of issues specifically what those concerns are, and then that provides an opportunity for further stakeholder comment or input into those issues, as well as providing us with the opportunity to further investigate, for example, by requiring the provision of documents or even through examination in hearings. So it kicks off, if you like, a more formal approach to collecting information and receiving comment from stakeholders about the specific competition issues that we've identified in our preliminary work.
You touched on it earlier, but the ACCC has said today that it has vertical integration concerns around this deal, but you're not so worried about horizontal overlap. Just what exactly do those two terms, what does that all mean?
Okay, horizontal is where there's competing business. So if we had two businesses who are both butcher shops in a suburb and they were proposing to merger, that would be a horizontal merger, and that would raise concerns about, what other competition is available and whether they can raise prices. In this situation, JBS already owns the facility at Port Wakefield, the slaughterhouse there. By acquiring Diamond Valley and Corowa, they potentially raise horizontal issues. But given that they're so geographically distant from each other and there's limits to how far live pigs are transported before they're slaughtered, there's not really much competition, for example, between those three facilities. So that that horizontal concern that might have been arising from that doesn't really emerge because of that geographical separation of those facilities. But post-slaughter, fresh pork and processed pork, of course, moves nationally from those. And by having control up and down the supply chain, for example, at the slaughter level, at the process level, and at the distribution level, there's ways in which competition can be diminished by a dominant player. So having that influence vertically through the supply chain is where the issues arise in relation to the JBS Rivoli proposal.
Deputy Chair of the ACCC, Mick Keogh, speaking with Peter Somerville. And staying with livestock, going from pigs to cattle, and a dispute between the largest beef exporting and the largest beef buying countries is heating up as the superpowers fight it out after the discovery of two mad cow cases. After an investigation of the two cases of atypical BSE, otherwise known as mad cow, in Brazil were finalised, trade had been expected to start again with China this week. However, meat industry analysts Simon Quilty says that's now unlikely as other countries have signed up to ban Brazil beef.
The situation between Brazil and China has taken a turn for the worst, you might say, for several reasons. But the main one is the disputing over the dates of the agreed suspension. And this is all about what we call pipeline product. This is product that they do not want on ships in the system that are not acceptable dates. And right now, they're arguing over, in the eyes of the Brazilians, that suspension date should have started September the 3rd. But in the eyes of the Chinese, it's shipments after September the 3rd. So that 6 days could represent anywhere between 20 to 30,000 metric tons of product that gets into the system that the Chinese will not accept.
This is interesting in the sense that there had been a largely acceptance in the market that the relationship between the world's largest beef exporter, Brazil, the world's largest beef buyer, China, was strong enough and the Chinese would open their doors back to Brazil quite quickly. But by the sounds of it, that doesn't seem like happening soon.
That's correct. I mean, it does put a cloud of doubt, I think, over when the lifting of the suspension or ban, call it what you may, will occur. Originally, we thought it was going to be at the end of this week, around about September the 19th, but there's no doubt to me that this will probably see an extension of the lifting of that ban.
And now other countries are getting involved?
Yes, they are. So to date, we have officially China, Indonesia, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. And market sources tell me that in addition, there's now Egypt and Iran. But to put things in perspective, these five other countries only make up 7% of Brazil's total beef exports. So the overall market impact, though concerning, is not going to be, you know, enormous, but it's the principle, I think, and the attention that it draws that is the concern for exporters and producers in Brazil.
What does this mean for Brazil's relationship with China, but also their relationship with these other countries?
I think it puts it strains the relationship without any doubt. Now, what is interesting is that global beef is tight. Meat globally is difficult. Prices are moving higher. And you would imagine that it's in the interest of these six countries, including China, to resolve these matters quickly, because I think their dependence upon Brazil is going to increase from here, given the tightness of global beef.
Bringing this back home to Australian farmers and the Australian industry, what does this news today mean for Australia?
I think it once again just lifts what I call the safety net under the market higher again in terms of global beef prices and strengthening them. So as you know, I've been saying for a good while that I expect prices to peak in October, November. I'm still of that opinion, but any corrections or falls, I think, will be much softer due to the rise of global beef prices and the lifting of this safety net.
What are you watching from here?
I think it's really that relationship between China and Brazil that's the most important factor, given that Brazil's dependency on China, 55% of its total exports go there. I think this is the most important thing, and how they resolve that dispute in terms of the product and the dates is the all-important factor. Because if the dispute continues and it goes well beyond the 19th, then I think the number of countries that will ban could increase.
Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends speaking with Warwick Long. Now, earlier this week, you heard about the memorandum of understanding between South Australia's Renascor Resources and South Korean company POSCO. Well, Renascor Resources has now been granted major project status for its $209 million Sivia project, which includes a graphite mine and concentrator located on the Eyre Peninsula near Arno Bay, and a downstream purified spherical graphite manufacturing facility in Port Adelaide. The project is now on track to become the first in-country integrated graphite mine and battery anode material operation outside of China. And the project is expected to support 100 new jobs during the construction phase and then an additional 190 full-time jobs over the 40-year life of the project. So quite a big project there with some perhaps newer materials, the graphite and things like that, that are now used in some of the newer technology that's coming through. You're listening to the Country Hour. I've got more to come, including weather coming up in the next 10 minutes or so. It is 19 minutes to one.
For nearly 30 years, Saturday Night Country has been Australia's home of country music.
I sent her a couple of tracks and she wrote back and she went, wow, I like this way more than I was expecting to.
Each week we bring you the very best tunes, news and interviews from here and around the world.
I like living on the road. I love it so much.
Every artist is different and what they want to achieve is different.
Just be yourself and just be real.
Join Becky Cole for Saturday Night Country. We're online and on ABC Radio.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
A new Australian record for new season lambs has been set in Wagga Wagga in New South Wales today. The 30-kilogram lambs made $340 each. So this livestock market is showing no signs of slowing down. And as I mentioned earlier, it was through the sale yards that my mother was able to let my father know that she was going into labour with my sister. They're quite an indelible intrinsic part of communities in regional Australia. So I'd love to know what a trip to the sale yards means to you. You can text me on 0467922891 or phone 1300 222 891. A new research project is actually asking Australian farmers and agents that very question, what a trip to the sale yards means to you, because the research, which is commissioned by the Australian Livestock Market Association, will be used to lobby government for funding by showing just how vital sale yards are to rural communities. Heather Ellis from Blue Wren Connections says there is more to livestock sales than just a business transaction.
The social connections and interactions, particularly I think at this point we've noticed, even particularly with some of our older members of the community, the joy that it brings, or I guess maybe it's even the sense of belonging and connection for everybody. It doesn't matter whether they're vendors, agents, buyers. I have a real sense that there's a sense of fun and camaraderie that happens at sale yards, with some of the banter and humour, as well as the serious end around buying and selling. And obviously business operates from sale yards, but there's a real sense of connection and the fun and the banter. There are so many other elements that are coming out that perhaps I hadn't even given thought to, which is quite interesting, which is quite variant depending on where those yards are located, some of the other aspects that sale yards offer. Some sets of yards have health professionals offering checkups, whether it's diabetes checkup or blood pressure, to people coming talking about well-being in terms of mental health. Some rural finance, some have mobile hairdresser that comes every week. It's quite interesting the different elements that happen in different communities.
So with that social connection, many farmers in remote communities, this might be their only opportunity or one of few opportunities to catch up with their colleagues and friends. What importance have you found that farmers particularly are putting on the social value of our sale yards?
This is interesting because in some ways I think potentially people might not have been able to articulate this until this question's been posed. I think the importance of coming together and connect at the yards, I guess it's seen as a business transaction, so people didn't really realise how much of that was a social outing as well and the benefits they get. But now when that's not been able to happen, they've missed that camaraderie and mateship, which is a bit different when if you just go in and say you're buying product from the produce store, you might bump into one or two people, but you're not getting to kind of bump in and have a chat with a range of different people. And so I think people are really noticing not being able to connect with their neighbours or peers. I guess the short answer is that there is a real impact when people are socially isolated and not able to come in and connect in a way that they would normally like to.
What's this research going to be used for?
I guess the hope is with this particular research that it can help shape and inform all levels of government, if it could be used in the livestock industry to shape future policy, potentially funding. It could also potentially be supportive for even in the community sector if it was identified that it was helpful having health checks. This would give evidence to say and support that actually having a funded worker, potentially place-based at the yards, a bit like having the hairdresser there, like it gives an argument for funding that kind of thing would be useful, because potentially people that attend yards might not actually prioritise health in terms of going in for checkups and things. So I guess there's a whole range of things we hope that this piece of research will be able to be utilised across lots of different platforms.
That's an interesting development. Perhaps you could get your flu jab or something there. That was Heather Ellis, Director of Research and Development Company Blue Wren Connections, speaking with Jane McNaughton about a research project that is asking Australian farmers and agents what a trip to the sale yards means to them. So if that is something you'd like to be involved with, you can speak with Blue Wren Connections. I'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now, though, where I'm joined by Senior Forecaster Vince Rollins. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie.
So it's a rather warm day today. What's happening across the state?
Yeah, it is. So we're seeing those northerly winds pick up today and being quite fresh and strong out in parts of the west, and seeing some pretty high temperatures in parts of Nullarbor. It's already hit 35 degrees today. Unadad is up to 33. So, yeah, those northerlies helping to drive those warmer conditions. And that's all ahead of a trough that is just sitting over the eastern parts of Western Australia at the moment. So we'll see that continue to move eastwards across the west a bit later today. So we'll see winds go around to the west, west-southwest, and bring cooler conditions over western parts later today. And then as that trough continues to move east, probably going through central districts, around sort of late morning tomorrow, and then across the eastern parts of the state. So we'll see those cooler conditions extending further east. Still pretty warm to hot in the eastern districts tomorrow initially, but as that trough continues its eastward trajectory, those cooler conditions will eventually extend right throughout the state. So by the end of Saturday, yeah, we are expecting that trough to have moved right across the state. Now, there's not a lot of rainfall with this system as it moves through, certainly quite a bit of wind, so we're seeing some of that wind today. It will be pretty windy over eastern central parts tomorrow as well, so looking at the possibility of some raised dust over eastern districts tomorrow. And with that wind, we do see some thunderstorm activity over the eastern border area. There's a risk we could see some significant gusts with those, so we'll be monitoring that as we head into this afternoon and tomorrow. But a bit of thunderstorm activity out in the west already today, mainly over the northwest pastoral, but it's pretty high based, pretty dry underneath, so we're not expecting any significant rainfall with those thunderstorms, mainly dry. But those thunderstorms will continue to track eastwards as well, so we are expecting some thunderstorms over eastern districts and then up in the far northeast during Saturday morning. And yeah, probably maybe tomorrow see a little bit more rainfall with them, but yeah, still not really significant rainfall associated with that system as it moves through. But we do get a frontal feature moving across the south of the state following this trough, so we will see some showers developing over the agricultural area. So some showers associated with the trough over the northern parts of the state, and then some showers associated with the frontal feature as it moves across the south. We'll see those showers in the south continuing basically right through until about Tuesday next week before we start to see them contracting south. So a little bit of activity over the mainly the southern agricultural area. A little bit of activity up in the mainly the north and northeast tomorrow, contracting to the far northeast on Saturday. But generally speaking, we're only looking at less than a couple of millimetres up until midnight Monday, maybe over the southern agricultural area, and with some thunderstorms in the north could see some falls up to about 5 millimetres. But most of the activity as far as rainfall goes is going to be about southern coast and the lower southeast. Maybe the Mount Lofty ranges as well could get some slightly higher falls. So unfortunately not a lot of rainfall with this system over the sort of northern agricultural area and pastoral district, so we'll have to wait and see what happens with the next system coming through. But following this initial trough and front, we've got another front moving across the south on Sunday, Monday. It's bringing some cold air with it, so we could see some hail and possible thunderstorms about the southeast districts on Monday. But that is followed by a high-pressure system that will move across the north of the state, so we will see a bit of a return to some cold conditions over inland parts during Sunday, so some areas of frost over the inland parts. And again, on Tuesday and Wednesday mornings, we could see some areas of frost over inland parts, so some cold mornings on the way. So unfortunately, not a lot of rainfall, some warmer temperatures today and tomorrow, certainly a fair bit of wind associated with that. So we do have some coastal wind warnings out, and we'll be looking at other warnings as needed as we get into this afternoon and tomorrow.
Well, shame there's not more rain in that. Hopefully there's more to come.
Yeah, hopefully. Just keep fingers crossed. I mean, we are hopefully going to see some more rain over the next few weeks.
Thanks for that. That was Vince Rollins from the Bureau of Meteorology. It certainly will be very welcome. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be partly cloudy. There is a medium chance of showers in the west, most likely in the late afternoon and evening. Not much rain anywhere else. But there could be a gusty thunderstorm in the west as well, because the wind could get up to 40 k's an hour. Overnight temperatures will get down to 7 to 16 degrees, but the daytime temperatures 27 to 32. In the lower western, there's a medium chance of showers, also a chance of a thunderstorm. It'll get down to 7 to 14 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach the mid to high 20s.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff.
Hi, it's great to have your company this afternoon. The announcement of a new defence partnership with the US and the UK has been big news today, but it might not sit all that well with other powerful nations in the region. Agriculture is a sector that has been targeted by China for tariffs and sanctions in the past year or so. So soon I'll have a look at what this new defence partnership could mean for Australia's ag sector. And you'd think living in a dry state like South Australia, capturing water in dams would make it easier for native animals to survive. But work on the South O'Leary Plains is actually removing dams to help restore the natural environment there.
You know, the birds and other animals in that landscape that evolved in that landscape evolved with the system as it was. So they're not used to having these permanent water sources all throughout the year. A lot of them actually get their water through the vegetation.
I'll have more on why they're doing that work in the Mallee soon, but first we'll have to find out what's making news with Wendy Glamachak. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi Cassie. As you've been discussing on the submarine news, as a resident who lives near the shipyards at Osborne in Adelaide's west, where Australia's nuclear-powered submarines will be built, is disgusted with the news of the change in plans for our submarine fleet. The Prime Minister's announced the move this morning in partnership with the US and UK. It means the $90 billion deal with French company Naval Group's being scrapped. Susan Johncock's lived at North Haven in Adelaide for 46 years, and she's very concerned about the prospect of having nuclear-powered subs built near her home. South Australia's jobless rate has increased slightly to 5% for the month of August. That's up from 4.7% in seasonally adjusted terms in July. The ABS figures show the national jobless rate fell to 4.5%. And influenza has all but disappeared from Australia, with experts saying that's thanks largely to the international border closures. In 2019, there were more than 300,000 cases and 950 deaths in our country from the flu. This year, not a single person has died, and there have been fewer than 500 cases. According to Australia's Health Department, there have been more than 78,500 cases of COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic, with 1,116 fatalities so far. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. There are, as I was saying, concerns that Australia's new defence partnership with the US and the UK, known as AUKUS, could create further trade headaches for Australia's agriculture sector. AUKUS is designed to sustain peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific region and will deliver a nuclear-powered submarine fleet for the Royal Australian Navy. And those submarines are expected to be built in Adelaide. But Professor Greg Barton, who is a security and expert and chair of the Islamic Politics at Deakin University, says Australia has been included in the deal mainly due to its geography.
America, of course, is concerned with the Pacific and its Pacific nation, but we straddle the Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean and face the world's largest archipelago with Indonesia and the Philippines to our north. It's a important regional issue for us. So it's a very natural relationship. Of course, there's this historical relationship between Australia, Britain and the UK. We're in this Five Eyes alliance coming out of World War II. So it's a very comfortable, easy relationship. It's hard for us in some ways. It puts a bigger target on our back. But I think it's the reality of where we are in the world.
The elephant in the room would have to be China, right? Is China driving the significance and the importance of this deal?
Absolutely. No one's even pretending it's not China. There's not even an attempt to sort of back away from naming the elephant. It is about China, and specifically about China under Xi Jinping these last 9 years. He says he wants to stay on indefinitely, so we have to factor that in. He's talked, nevertheless, about unifying mainland China and Taiwan, as he puts it, before he leaves office. So that's a worrying footnote. And, of course, it's the expansion of Chinese naval bases into artificial islands in the South China Sea and then claiming the South China Sea as historical Chinese territory, that's really upped things. And in the sense, that happened while we were napping. You know, Biden's emphasis on getting out of Afghanistan is partly a recognition that the 20-year war on terror has seen us not paying as much attention to China expansion as we should. So there is a certain sort of logic with this catching up. It's not surprising when you look back in hindsight, but the news overnight, of course, was surprising.
So how do you think China will react to today's news? I mean, the trade partnership that we have with them has been put under such enormous pressure. There are people listening in Western Australia from agricultural communities that are suffering still today because of bans or tariffs on products that we would normally sell to China. Are they likely to react with an economic hammer quickly?
They are likely to react quickly, and it could well cost us, so we should be anxious about that. I mean, so far, most of those trade reactions have been areas where China can afford to go hard. They've stayed away from the things that they most need. So there's that calculation. But, you know, I can understand Australian farmers, West Australian farmers should be concerned. There will be a lot of bluff and bluster. It'll play out in things like international students and trade. And that's a concern. But we need to sort of separate out the public sort of facing as much for Chinese domestic consumption and international of sort of nationalist strong rhetoric from behind the scenes quiet understanding. And there's still the hope that this will settle the relationship down and put it on a sort of more rational footing. It's key now to try and really invest in the relationship and work all the harder the diplomatic side, because this is going to draw out that sort of nationalist rhetoric, and some of it's going to spray our way in terms of impacting on the trade relationship. But I don't think that can be avoided.
I encourage the diplomacy at all times, and I'm not trying to be fear-mongering, but if you're in Western Australia and you're an iron ore producer, or perhaps you're in Queensland and you ship out coking coal, maybe gas even out of the northwest here in Western Australia that go to steel making. China has been holding steel making steady and then slowing it down and then quickening it up, and really all of those little moves sort of, if they sneeze, we catch the cold, I think. So for those that are involved in China's steel making, like for the iron ore producers in WA, will they be nervous this morning?
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be nervous, but I think the thing to watch is domestic consumption in China. The reason that China hasn't backed away from our steel and coking coal, et cetera, is because they need it. But the extent to which they need it is driven by the Chinese domestic economy. With downturn in their construction markets, a sense of a housing bubble, overbuilding, oversupply, that's the big driver for what China does. And that is a reminder, by the way, that to the extent we can all avoid open military confrontation, which is destructive and wasteful and causes uncertainty and is, to say the least, bad for the economy, then there's more hope that the Chinese economy can remain stable and that their domestic demand will remain strong and they'll buy our stuff. But it really comes down to that. So you can separate out the rhetoric of politics, which is playing to a domestic audience in China, particularly in terms of nationalist speak, from the reality of they'll buy what they need depending on how strongly or slowly their economy is growing.
Professor Greg Barton, a security expert and chair in Islamic politics at Deakin University, speaking with Russell Wolfe. Now, more than 30 major clothing brands, including Adidas, Kathmandu and Patagonia, are the latest companies to phase out their use of mulesed wool. Animal activist organisation Four Paws recently presented an open letter featuring fashion brands promising to use only non-mulesed wool by 2030. Lucas Forbes took a look at this.
Major clothing brands may be signalling their support for non-mulesed wool, but now the question is, where do they get it? Four Paws' Rebecca Piqueo is behind the campaign to get companies to promise not to use mulesed wool by 2030, but says at present there isn't enough non-mulesed wool available.
This letter is mainly about addressing the Australian wool industry. It's about making these voices heard from brands, making their demands heard, and showing that they are ready to commit, but they need the help of the Australian wool industry. So they need the industry to enable the shift away. Because the biggest concern is definitely the planning, security, and that the supply doesn't keep up with the demand.
Mulesing involves surgically removing wrinkly skin around the breech and tail area of a sheep to prevent it from getting infested by Australian sheep blowflies, which can be very painful and deadly for sheep. However, Ms. Bacayo says the procedure itself causes too much pain in sheep.
Of course, if it's an emergency, I think the survival of the animal is the priority, but mulesing as a long-term strategy is unacceptable if there are tested and available pain-free alternatives. And while pain relief given pre- and post-mulesing can significantly help to reduce the pain cost, pain relief is mostly only applied post-mulesing, which is not enough.
Four Paws, Rebecca Pacayo speaking. Australian Wool Growers Association President Robert McBride says Australian producers do take good care of their sheep, but admits the days of mulesing are numbered.
Lucas, without a doubt, the days are numbered, but as far as that time frame is concerned, I'm not acknowledged to know what that is. But when a suitable alternative comes out into the marketplace, whether it be a large plain-bodied sheep, other alternatives, I'm sure the industry will adapt to the environment, and that's what we're endeavouring to do. We show the world that we are looking after that animal 24/7 and 24 hours, 7 days a week. We undertake the best animal husbandry practices of any animal species probably on the planet. We're pretty proud of what we do as wool producers. It's not a part-time job. You're 24/7 and you take pride in what you do. Nobody wants to see any animal suffer.
Mr. McBride says the Australian wool industry is looking for alternatives to mulesing, but he says so far the industry has yet to find a cost-effective solution.
Endeavour to take them up quickly, but at this juncture in time, we just haven't found it, Lucas, the suitable alternative. There's been a lot of different pegs, there's been a lot of different freeze-drying, there's been a lot of different alternatives, but at this juncture in time, we just haven't found the suitable alternative. But we do understand the consumers, and we respect the consumers. At the end of the day, if we're not providing the product they want, they're not going to buy it. But we are undertaking, as an industry, best practice, and we look towards having a good alternative, hopefully in the not-too-distant future.
Australian Wool Growers Association President Robert McBride speaking there. Wool Producers Australia CEO Joe Hall says the industry has tried to educate consumers and companies about why the industry uses mulesing, but that it may be too late.
I think it's because the wool industry hasn't properly explained over the years why this procedure is done. And it's also why Wool Producers Australia launched our Trust in Australian Wool campaign this year. Some may say it's too late for mulesing, but it is about ensuring that going forward that we're telling not just the trade but the general public all of the positive things that we do relating to the production of wool in Australia.
Why do you think, though, that more producers haven't moved to non-mules wool?
The reality is mulesing is very effective for breech fly strike prevention. So it's also quite cost effective. And I also don't think that the market signals or market trends have been getting back to grassroots producers in Australia about the concerns, the serious concerns that many brands have around this practice.
Ms. Hall says she's also concerned groups like Four Paws may be trying to get rid of mulesing to slowly make animal agriculture impractical.
Four Paws as an animal rights group has an agenda here. It's not just related to mulesing. They're probably a group that we won't ever appease and probably won't try to.
So you think that they're trying to end sheep production?
I would suggest that, yes.
However, Four Paws Rebecca Pacayo says the world is moving towards non-mulesed wool and agriculture needs to adapt.
It's always amused me that the industry feels that we want to end all their livelihoods when in fact we want to help them to prepare for the future. And I think the industry, of course, there are some industry players who will never support or are blocking even the transition away from mulesing, but seeing all the other positive developments, given us the confidence that the industry is actually more ready than ever to transition away from mulesing, and the momentum is now.
Four Paws, Rebecca Pacayo, ending that story from Lucas Forbes. Do you look for unmulesed wool when you're buying wool products? This issue has been around for a couple of decades now. It's been occasionally in the headlines. So has it affected your buying habits? Or as one of the speakers there said, that it really hasn't reached from the consumer to the sheep producer yet. Text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891 if you have some thoughts on whether unmused wool is getting more traction in the marketplace now. I'd be interested to know your thoughts as it is 16 minutes to 1.
Afternoons with Sonia Feldhoff.
The avocado industry have launched a quality monitoring project, heading out into supermarkets to check the quality of avocados out there. And as someone who is an avocado lover, I believe they can be sending you to heaven when they are perfect. But see an avocado turn, get a little bit of the brown bit, that rot in avocados. They can ruin an entire dish and take you to hell, in my view.
Sonia Feldhoff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Bulldozers are being deployed to destroy dams and drive away kangaroos, rabbits and other herbivores in a bid to restore the South O'Leary Plains in the Riverland. Environmental groups are carrying out the project on a piece of land that's actually twice the size of Kangaroo Island, so it's a big area where the River Murray meets the outback. Murraylands and Riverland Landscape Board's Wendy Stubbs told Eliza Ballage that while conservation works began 30 years ago, the state government grant will support a renewed push to return the landscape to its original state.
Differing landholders have done different things to try and manage that land. We've sort of, I guess, really kind of kick-started this and really upscaled this restoration attempts probably about two and a half years ago when we got some money from the federal government to do some work on the threatened mallee birds, which is when we really went, right, let's try and knock over some of these dams and try and restore some of the water back to the landscape.
I imagine just to the, you know, everyday person who might live in town might go, oh, removing water from an area where you've got animals and plants seems like the opposite. But that's, I guess, they're man-made. Can you tell me a bit more about why that's being done and what that will involve?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. A lot of people say exactly that. It's a dry environment. Aren't you taking water away from the very, you know, animals that you're trying to maintain? Well, the answer is that we're not, because, you know, the birds and other animals in that landscape that evolved in that landscape evolved with the system as it was. So they're not used to having these permanent water sources all throughout the year. A lot of them actually get their water through the vegetation. But it is a really important point, because when the pastoralists moved up there, because it is such a dry environment, to capture enough water in their dams, of course, they built extensive drainage systems across that landscape. And what that effectively did is it captured every last bit of water that was being dropped across that landscape and fed it all into the dam so that they had it available for their livestock. But what that's meant, of course, consequently for the environment, is all of that water that would have naturally flowed across that landscape and provided enough water for plants and thereby through to the animals that ate those plants, then it's not there. So we've actually taken a whole lot of water out of the landscape by putting it into dams, and by knocking over the dams and the associated drainage structures, which is what we're doing as part of this project, we're actually returning that water back to the landscape and back to the plants and animals that use that area.
And do you have any ongoing involvement with First Nations people in this project?
Yeah, absolutely. So they will continue to do more cultural surveys, because we're knocking over more dams and drains, so that's a constant process throughout this project. But in addition to that, this grant also allowed us to work with them in another way and try and work with them to work out how else they would like to be engaged to help connect them back to that landscape. We've also looked for all sorts of ways of directly employing them through this project. So another element of this project is to undertake a whole lot of restoration works. Of course, knocking over the dams and the drains is great, but it's going to take a long time for the system to recover, if ever, because we've affected it so badly. So we're actually doing some revegetation works after we've knocked over the dams, which means we need to collect seeds, we need to grow them. All of those works, where possible, we're employing traditional owners as well to help us with that work.
Murraylands and Riverland Landscape Board's Wendy Stubbs speaking with Eliza Ballage. Christine from Prospect has written in to say that she doesn't buy wool anymore because of cruelty. But Peter from Eden Hills has asked what mulesing is. It's basically the removal of skin around the breech or the backside of a lamb when it's quite young to deal with the issues associated with fly strike, which is when a fly will lay its eggs on a lamb or a sheep and in turn, they will eventually kill the sheep by eating into the skin. So it's done to help prevent that. It doesn't stop it completely, but it's one of the ways that Australian farmers for years have tried to prevent that issue of fly strike. But it is considered cruel by some people in society. And as a result, there is an issue around mulesing where some, as we were saying, retailers don't want to use mules wool anymore. So that's an answer to your question there, Peter, as to what mulesing is. And we'll move on now from the mulesing and the South O'Leary Plains to Port Lincoln over on the Eyre Peninsula, where the mussel industry is continuing its fight to stop a South Australian desalination plant being placed near key mussel growing areas. SA Water has not yet decided where that desal plant will go, but it has flagged Billy Light's Point as an option. Marine biologist Paul McShane is working with mussel growers looking at the potential impacts of the proposed plant on the mussel industry. He says, while they are not against the plant on the Eyre Peninsula, the risks are too great to have it situated at Billy Light's Point.
South Australia has Australia's largest and most valuable mussel aquaculture production, so it's of concern to them that a desalination plant would be located right next to their harvesting area. My report was basically a desktop study of relevant literature that examined worldwide and in Australia potential impacts of desalination plants.
What have you found?
The literature recommends that where desalination plants operate, that they be situated in high energy coastlines to disperse the hypersaline effluent, and also to avoid situating desalination plants near what they would call valuable biological resources. So sites of high conservation significance, or in this case, sites which support marine farming, particularly filter feeding animals such as mussels, which basically filter the seawater and anything that's contained in them. The biggest concern is that the discharge of hypersaline effluent, and we're talking more than 50 megalitres per day, would have a impact on the nearshore ecosystem, principally because Proper Bay and Boston Bay are relatively sheltered waters. So compared with oceanic environments, you're not going to get the same sort of dispersal of the hypersaline effluent and any pollutants contained in that effluent as you would in an oceanic environment.
What are you hoping can come from this study that you've done?
Well, I note that SA Water hasn't made up their mind as to where the final site for the desalination plant to service the Eyre Peninsula. Obviously, there's a need to provide or meet demand for increasing fresh water, but I'm hoping that they would note that it is an inappropriate site to locate a desalination plant and perhaps relocate it to the west of Port Lincoln, where there are exposed ocean sites which would be far more appropriate.
Marine biologist Paul McShane, SA Water, says it's pleased with the community consultation it's had so far with locals. General Manager for Sustainable Infrastructure Amanda Lurie says they're looking at all options and a site is yet to be decided on.
We're really grateful for the input that they're providing SA Water, and it really is shaping our thoughts and our input into the project. A lot of the studies that we're doing are actually building on work that the aquaculture industry already has.
One of the concerns that the mussel industry in particular has is that where desal plants operate, they need to be situated at a high energy coastline to be able to disperse the highly saline effluent. So I guess the question is there anything that can be used at the site if it's put at Billy Light's Point that can help disperse the effluent better and away from the mussel industry?
There are a number of desalination plants here locally in South Australia, nationally and internationally, that don't operate in high energy waterways. But part of the design and some of the information that we're collecting through the additional data will inform the engineering design. So there are multiple engineering solutions available to us where our outfall and where our discharge goes to disperse the saline waste.
SA Water General Manager for Sustainable Infrastructure, Amanda Lurie, speaking with Brooke Nindorf. I've had a text in from Pat from Noarlunga who says, to see a lamb mulesed is heart-wrenching, so to earmarking and lamb tailing. To observe the pain, infection and masses of maggots that infiltrate beneath the tail along the back and deep into the flesh is also heartbreaking. So what is the worst of the two options? That is the question that a lot of people have been asking, Pat. Both are pretty detrimental to sheep, so it's something that the industry will continue to try to deal with. Also, Max at Lindox says he is not a wool grower, but these groups trying to save the planet should put their efforts into ridding us of the synthetic fibre industry. Thanks for your text there. Finally today, Rotary has handed out about $500,000 to a South Australian farmers through $500 gift cards in the past 12 months. The program was funded by the federal government and is meant to help farmers pay for everyday expenses while experiencing tough times. However, Rotary Drought Coordinator Bob Cooper says the rollout has been slowed somewhat by COVID.
We're into the third stage of the delivery of these gift cards. The $500 gift cards initiative of the federal government, where they gave Rotary a substantial amount of money to actually distribute to the farming community that have been affected by the drought across Australia. And we in South Australia have given out in the last 12 months about 1,000 cards, so that's nearly $500,000 worth of cards going out to the farming community. These cards are basically a gift card, and the people can spend the money on any good, but we would like them to spend it in their local community, so that money goes around within the local community to support not only themselves but also their local shopkeepers. And the idea is that farmers are entitled to this card if they have a PIC number or an NGR number, in other words, to prove that they are actually a farmer, and that they are in the drought-affected area in South Australia, which is nearly two-thirds of South Australia.
Has demand dropped off recently because there has been a bit of rain these past couple of years?
Yes, in the last few months, we've had some good rains, but, you know, we're still in a recovery mode. A lot of farmers have put in their crops this year, but they haven't been paid for them yet. So they've expended money, but they still haven't got the return back. The same with livestock. You know, livestock prices have gone up incredibly, and they can't really afford to replace their livestock. So this $500 gift card is more just to help in the family situation for household expenses generally. And it's, you know, not a lot of money, but it's what it is, it's... Firstly, it gives them just something to spend for their household. But secondly, I think they appreciate, the farmers appreciate the fact that somebody's thinking of them.
Mr. Cooper, I suppose, how long before the money supporting these cards runs out?
Okay. We think we've probably got another 6 months' worth of distribution of these cards when we go around to the community events. These community events are actually being coordinated by the Commonwealth Government Drought Relief Agency, and we try and target areas where there's still drought concerns. And then, we were going to go over to New South Wales as well, but at the moment we can't get into New South Wales because of COVID. So
how many of these cards have been rolled out nationally, and is that where you wanted to be at this stage when this program started?
There are about 6,000 cards nationally have been distributed across, you know, New South Wales, Queensland, parts of Victoria, Western Australia, and even into Tasmania. There's a section in Tasmania where there's been drought as well, surprisingly. Now, how long do we think that this is going to go for? We think probably the next 6 months we'll have sufficient funds. So if people can come along to these events that are being organised, they're usually advertised through the local media, through the radio or the local newspaper or a Facebook or other, you know, electronic mediums, but also word of mouth. If you hear from somebody, or, you know, a stock agent or somebody from Purser about this particular program, come along and we can fill out an application form and you can have the opportunity to get a $500 gift card.
Rotary Drought Coordinator Bob Cooper speaking with Lucas Forbes there about that work that Rotary's doing to help out people experiencing some tough times there. A couple of last texts have come through. Kaz has said, as an agriculturalist, I've seen both sides of mulesing and non-mulesing. Both have their ugliness. However, seeing a sheep literally being eaten away by maggots is devastating and costly. Are these processing organisations doing something to find a replacement for mulesing? I will continue to support businesses who create woolen products. Thanks so much for that text, Kaz. Now, that's almost all I have time for, but Sonia Feldoff, what's coming up?
Now, if you live in the Barossa Valley, have you been noticing that there's a plane flying overhead at night? It's certainly causing quite a stir. We can give you the answer to what's actually going on with those planes that you might be noticing, and it's of interest to all of us about what they're doing. You might think we're closer to the Cold War given the announcements today, but I can tell you it doesn't have anything to do with that.
That's a relief.
Having said that, I'm guessing that we all have a few problems with remembering names, not necessarily when you're making a major announcement and of a fellow world leader. However, if
that
you
fella
have
from down under,
that fella, high pow, if you have trouble remembering names, we're going to be speaking to Australia's best memory expert about what you can do to perhaps try it better to remember names.
Very interesting. We'll keep listening to ABC Local Radio with Sonia Feldoff. That's about it from me, though. If you want to find out more on agriculture in Australia, go online to abc.net.au/rural. Right now, though, it is coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.